Hi, this is John with a super brief disclaimer that the topics discussed on today's edition of Mormon Stories podcast are very sensitive and kind of controversial, and many are going to see them as somewhat critical or negative of Joseph Smith. So please don't listen if you have sensitive ears, if your testimony is sensitive or fragile, or if you're just tired of negative things on Mormon Stories, because this is a tough one. But please know that we're committed on Mormon Stories to being fair and balanced and to be a safe place for believers and non-believers. So we'll do our best to make sure that happens, but this one's a tough one. So listen if you feel so inclined, but don't hesitate to put it down if you don't. And now to the wonderful and incomparable Grant Palmer. Thanks a lot. Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. Okay, great. Well, let's move on then to the William Law story. And I don't want to just dive into the particulars without painting a bit of a, you know, just a bit of context, setting a bit of context for the story. So we're not looking for you to recount specifics. We're not going to hold you to any details. We just want to get an overall feel for what's going on. So tell us a bit about William Law so that then we can understand why this is significant.
Okay. I don't pretend to have a deep understanding of William and Jane Law's life. Frankly, we need a first-class biography of the man. The research I did, let me just say, he was born in Ireland in 1809, came to Western Pennsylvania when he's 10 years old. His family, he's only a 10-year-old, he migrates up near Toronto, Canada, and there he marries his wife, Jane. They joined the church in 1836 in Toronto. That's 1836.
Right.
He's late on the scene.
Okay.
Then moved to Nauvoo in 39. In 41, he's a member of the first presidency.
Now, how does that happen, I wonder?
Yeah. He's very industrious. He has money. He's has mills. He has this. And he was all I could ever find in his – before he joined Mormonism, he was a very good man. All I could ever find after he left Mormonism, he was a very good man. He, he's excommunicated in the church in April of 44, just, you know, a couple of months before Joseph dies or is killed. And then they left Nauvoo never to return in June of 44. And his last 40 years were spent in Apple River, Illinois, and Shoalsburg, Wisconsin, where he was a medical doctor. And if you go up there and the little probing I've done, he had a very good reputation. He raised a very good family. I think he had five or six children. I know one of them was a physician and one was a judge. These are fairly prominent people. And I mean, obviously, Joseph Smith saw something in young lawyers. He comes to Nauvoo in 39, and 2 years later, he's in the first presidency? Wow. So anyway, that I think he was a good man all during his life, but I'm not going to defend that to the death because
right.
Someone needs to do a major biography on the man, and I'm just giving three of many reasons why he's leaving the church.
And there's a decent chance that in addition to whatever righteousness and reputation that he has, you could probably attribute his rapid ascent to the first presidency to the fact that he was a person of means, right?
I'm sure that's one of the reasons, but he had a pretty level head. He was I think he was a good man. I think he had leadership qualities and what have you. That's why I say I think he's the most important person to ever leave because he has a certain credibility. At least that's the way he came across to me.
Okay. So,
did he ever tell a lie? Sure. Was he a little self-righteous? I think so. But I don't want to paint a picture here of a perfect human being. That he was not.
Okay, got it. So So what do we know about his leaving and why he left?
Well, I give just three reasons here in this paper, and I don't know how deep you want to go into this, but the
Let's
first one.
just paint a story. Let's tell the story the best we can.
Well, William Law says that once, and more of this will come out as we have this discussion, but they were excommunicated, he and Jane Law, in April 18th of 44. And thereafter, the Laws got death threats. Law claims that he and that Joseph and Hiram tried to poison him at a banquet, and back then you couldn't tell very well. Dr. Foster, who was a medical doctor, and Law did a little bit of medicine in Nauvoo. He had some idea, but we don't know that. But by June, they're actually driven from the community. They lose about $30,000 worth of property. He and his brother Wilson, who was not a member of the church, by the way, Wilson Law, and that was a standard procedure, according to William, that when someone did something that Joseph didn't like, they'd put a freeze on your property, and nobody would buy it unless you had his permission. So they lost their residences, they lost their farms, and they lost some city lots that they owned. They valued about $30,000 in that era,
Which
in
is a
that thing.
huge amount of money back then.
Yeah, and so they left, never to return. And you have to understand that William Law and Jane Law were so mortified, they felt they were duped. They're like the old couple on television who lost all their money, and they don't want to talk about how they lost it. They were so mortified that once they left Nauvoo after about August, they didn't talk about Mormonism for 43 years. The only reason they brought it up is because their son, Thomas Law, the judge in Wisconsin now, prevailed upon him, and he gave one oral interview, and then he wrote three questions. It was so painful to him. He says the worst thing he ever did was join the Mormonism. Jane Law burned all the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants and what have you. I mean, they felt like they were duped. They thought it was the worst thing that ever happened to them, that they had joined the LDS Church, and they didn't want to talk about it. And they didn't for
Okay.
43 years.
Okay. So we don't really get their story other than what came out in the Nauvoo Expositor, right?
Well, no, because William Law wrote a 1844 diary, but it was never published, to my understanding, until 1994 by Lyndon Cook.
Really?
Yes.
Is it viewed as a credible biography?
No, it's just Law just writing down what happens day to day. So we know what he thought because he recorded it at the time.
Okay, all right.
But he never talked about it, and he never published it. And I don't know how the church got a hold of it, but they did, and they have a copy of it.
But no one's challenging the credibility of the biography, like a forgery or anything like that.
Not to my knowledge.
Okay, all right.
And
Okay.
then we have the three letters and the oral interview that he did in 1887. That's after 43 years of total silence.
Okay. All right. But didn't he have something to do with the Nauvoo Expositor too?
Yeah, but let's back up here. The first thing that really bothers the Laws is that they believe that Joseph Smith ordered the death of his enemies. And let me say right up front, the reasons why people are leaving the church today for academic, intellectual reasons, this is not the reasons why William and Jane Law left the church. People will be shocked for why they're leaving the church. They're not leaving the church because the Book of Mormon isn't the Word of God. They even say that in the Nauvoo Expositor, by the way. They believe in the Doctrine and Covenants. It's the other things that they don't. They don't question the priesthood restoration, the witnesses of the Book of Mormon, the historicity of the Book of Mormon, the first, you know, yeah, first. They don't question any of the things that modern day people who look at this stuff and get disturbed by it. This is not why they're leaving. And this is what attracted me to this project in the first place. They're on a whole different time frame. So the first thing they're saying is that they were deeply disturbed that Joseph Smith would try to kill his enemies. Now, that is so strong sounding that I'm not sure a true believer would even believe what I just said. And I'm not going to defend it. I'm just trying to say what bothered the laws, okay?
Right.
The first thing they did is they got that Joseph Smith in 1841 prophesied in Nauvoo in a grove that Boggs would die a violent death within 1 year.
This is the governor of Missouri that people say was responsible, that issued the extermination order on Mormons, right?
Yeah, there again, Joseph Smith is really upset that ex-governor Liburn W. Boggs drove the LDS Church out of Missouri.
Right.
Now they're settled in Nauvoo, and Joseph has, according to the laws, he can't let it go. They can't have a Christian attitude towards it. The laws say just let it go. He says he couldn't do that. He hired Orrin Porter Rockwell to go do the deed. And you have to understand that Rockwell was a real lackey. That's what William Law calls him. He was a lackey for anything Joseph Smith wanted to do. He'd fix the mansion house. He'd fix everything. He would do whatever he wanted. And according to this, he went and shot Boggs through his window at his residence in Independence, Missouri.
And this is something that's been rumored for a long time, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard of this. Independent of anything I've heard about William Law.
But as soon as it happens, the sitting governor of Illinois named Thomas Carlin writes Joseph Smith a letter, and he says, you know, you've threatened my life too, but I haven't taken you seriously until now, because I know for a fact that you predicted that Boggs would die a violent death within a year. Now, where is that coming from? Well, that's coming from then John C. Bennett, who's not the best source in the world, I grant you that, but then he was assistant to the first presidency of the church because Sidney Rigdon had fallen ill, and so you basically have John C. Bennett as an assistant to the first president, William Law is the second counselor, and Rigdon is still first counselor, but he's ailing. So he's in, and so according to Bennett, he says, now we have Carlin's statement, we have Bennett's statement in 41, a public congregation in Nauvoo, that he would die within 1 year.
Okay, so Grant, let's summarize where we are now. So you're saying that maybe the first reason that the laws, you know, left the church and were scared was because they feared for their lives, because they report to feel pretty certain that Joseph had ordered the assassination of Boggs, and that Boggs there was an assassination attempt on him, and so they were probably fearing for their lives. Is that potentially true?
Well, that was a very big a red light for them. Now, you've got Thomas Carlin writing a letter to Joseph and saying, look, I didn't take the Boggs threats you made on him seriously, but now that he's been shot, and he miraculously lived, by the way, he's shot three or four times, twice in the head, but he lived. And so Carlin's writing a letter saying, I'm putting you on notice here. I've got that document. And then Carlin has heard about the predictions that Boggs will die a violent death. Other members have also, including John C. Bennett. And Bennett says, Joseph was, I was in the first presidency with him, at least assistant to the first presidency. And one day I noticed that Porter Rockwell was gone. I says, where's Porter Rockwell? And he says, gone to fulfill prophecy.
Right. Now, of course, you mentioned this, you alluded to this, but John C. Bennett is viewed as kind of a scoundrel by many sources,
including William Law.
Right. And let me just ask you just
Well,
oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Let me just finish the prediction part of this.
Sure, sure.
So other members, when Joseph started denying, no, I haven't made this prediction in the Nauvoo newspapers and in the Sagamo Journal in Illinois, Joseph got letters, and I have some of those letters saying, denying you have prophesied the violent death of Boggs won't do at all. Too many people have heard you, myself included. That's one wrote in. And then the most important testimony, I think, here is that Joseph, William Law says he told me flat out that he had sent Rockwell to assassinate Boggs. And he almost gives the exact words. Let me tell you that Joseph Smith told me the fact himself. The words were substantially like this. I sent Rockwell to kill Boggs, but he missed him. It was a failure. He wounded him instead of sending him to hell, unquote. So you got two members in the first presidency closely associated with Smith that are claiming that they've had, that Smith told them this. Now, it's interesting to me that after all these years, after 43 years, it's now 1887, and Dr. William Weil is going to interview Law. And before any questions are even asked, Law made that statement. So you know it's on his mind and been bothering him for a long time. And it's something so graphic, I doubt that even the lapse of time would have completely diminished his memory on such a such a testimony by Joseph Smith. Anyway, so that's the prediction there. Now, enter Joseph Jackson. Now, a whole book is going to be written on Jackson. It'll probably be published by Signature Book by a very good Illinois historian that I know. And he came from Georgia to Nauvoo and met Joseph in May of 43, and he had a rather sordid past. And according to Jackson, Smith said that I was just the man he wanted. Well, then he hired Jackson to go finish what Rockwell failed to do. He offered him a pretty substantial sum of money, and he gives his story. It's rather, I won't read it all. So that's kind of the Boggs story. Now, about a month later, Joseph gets section 132 in the Doctrine and Covenants. And there it says that Joseph has his exaltation. There's only one thing that can keep him from being exalted, and that is you cannot shed innocent blood. And the thought occurred to me, I don't think, or it's a possibility that Joseph regarded Boggs not as innocent blood, but as guilty blood.
Right.
And therefore there would be no eternal consequence, and he didn't seem to fear the law. I just thought that was kind of interesting. So that's the first thing that really, I think, bothered. There's a number of things that bothered him. I'm just talking about three of the
things. Right. And that innocent blood notion, you know, maybe that forms the beginnings of what later became Brigham Young's whole emphasis on blood atonement.
Mountain Meadow Massacre, the Lafferty's doing their thing.
Yeah, it's
fundamentalist.
Like,
yeah,
it's like Brigham learns from Joseph that there's such thing as guilty blood and innocent blood, and maybe it's okay for guilty blood to be shed.
And see, Joseph Jackson says, I was playing along with this because, you know, blah blah blah. But he says he had such a calm. It's like heaven had commanded him to have this murder committed. He had seemingly no guilt or conscience about it. And I wonder if that's the reason Smith could have been so calm about ordering the death of Boggs.
Okay, so before we go into reason number two, one quick question: Is William Law's journal published?
Yes, in 1994, his diary.
His diary is published, and yes. Is it good stuff? Is it interesting?
It is, but it was done by Lyndon Cook, who's a BYU professor, and it was published in BYU Studies. He's a part-time BYU professor at the time. So, you know, I think he's been a little careful in order to get it published, but I think that the diary speaks for itself in another area of what the laws believe. Now, if someone wants to refute it, okay.
Okay, all right. But that's a good read. Okay, so let's go
it's
on.
It's in the paper that will be on my homepage.
Okay, got it. Okay, so what's the second reason that you're saying the law has left the church?
A couple of immoral proposals. And it's pretty well known to members of the LDS Church that Joseph Smith had at least 33 documented wives. Some of them were teenagers, some of them were married women, some of them were older singles over their teens. But by June 23, 1843, and I say that date because William Clayton, this is Joseph's private secretary, he records in his journal that day, he says, Emma Smith and Joseph had a conversation which I was privy to. And Emma is saying, Joseph, if you can have all these wives, and by that date, June of 43, he has 21 plural wives. He says, if you can have 21 plural wives, I ought to be able to have at least one man for myself. And I want William Law because, quote, he's a sweet little man, unquote.
Okay. All right. So is she missing her husband because he's busy?
And so William Law says, well, let me tell you. And so in the Doctrine and Covenants, section 132, verse 51, is written a revelation that's later embedded into section 132, which was given on July 12th, 1843. So this happens sometime between Clayton's comment in June of 23rd, 1843, and before the revelation on polygamy in July 12th, 1843. A couple of weeks. Okay, I just set that up for the reader or for the listener. So Jackson seems to know about this stuff, and this is what he says. Emma wanted Law for a spiritual husband, and she urges the reason that he had so many spiritual wives, she thought it but fair that she should have at least one man, and she wants Law because he's such a sweet little man. Well, in section 132, verse 51, it says, commandment I give unto my handmaiden Emma Smith, which I commanded you, Joseph, to offer unto her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, the offer is, I think Jackson's got a little bit wrong because he thinks it's going to be a quartet. In other words, William and Jane Law and Joseph and Emma Smith are going to do a little wife swapping.
Swinging, basically.
Swinging, yeah.
Okay.
And, but that's not what is going down according to Law. They later ask him in his oral interview, and he says, no, it's not wife swapping. Joseph offers, Emma says, Joseph, if you can do it, I can do it too. That's William Clayton, secretary of Joseph. And then William Law describes what the offer is as described in section 132, verse 51. The offer is that she is to be a substitute. That's the word he used, a substitute for Joseph Smith. Why? Because Joseph has seven young wives in the mansion house, and Emma's supposed to smile all the time, and she doesn't like it. And she harasses Joseph all the time about having all these wives. She knows about it. And so he says, okay, I will give you William Law or somebody else as a substitute. And they take that to the, so Joseph and Emma are agreed about this. They take it to the laws, and the laws turn it down. I think this is ridiculous. So.
And again, where do we learn about this? Joseph and Emma approaching the laws about Emma having William Law. What's the source for that? Do you remember?
Doctrine and Covenants, 132, verse 51.
Let's read that real quick.
I just read it.
Oh.
This is the, it's generic. It says, quote, a commandment I give unto my handmaiden, Emma Smith, which I command you, Joseph, to offer unto her. Okay, that's the first part of it, okay?
Okay.
William Law tells us what that offer is or was.
Okay.
And that's, we've discussed that, right?
Okay, yeah, okay. I'm just making sure. So.
Okay, and then.
Now, is this just your interpretation, or is this accepted by other historians that you talk to?
I think it's getting to be pretty accepted, but I can't speak for all of them, of course.
Okay, but I mean, you have other
Oh, we
reputable
have.
friends who, historical friends, maybe even
Well,
faithful ones
oh yeah, oh yeah.
that recognize that Emma was looking to have William Law as a spiritual husband, and that Joseph was willing to go along with that, and then the
Okay,
laws.
this is where Law disagrees with Jackson. Jackson says it's a spiritual husband. Law says, no, it wasn't to be a spiritual husband. It was to be a substitute for Joseph.
Okay.
In other words, Joseph and Emma would live together, and William and Jane would live together, but there would be a little
Yeah.
gift or a substitute for Joseph, in sexual substitute, because she was so lonely, because he was spending all this time with all these 21 plural wives at that point.
Oh.
That's what Law says happens. It's not wife swapping.
Right.
Okay.
So this is kind of crazy, right? This is like kind of crazy.
It's really crazy when you think that what the first presidency of the church is doing. Joseph is already asked Nancy Rigdon to be his spiritual wife, and what's wrong under one circumstance is right under another. You're familiar with that statement. So Rigdon is pulled in, he's his first counselor, and now you got Law being asked to be a substitute for him sexually. You got John C. Bennett that's running around Nauvoo using Joseph's name to have sex with women and being somewhat successful. And then, Emma's saying my husband commits adultery and polygamy. So the whole first presidency is kind of it's really a mess.
Except William Law.
Except William Law, that's right. And they turn him down, and then and as soon as they turn him down, somewhere between June 23rd and July 11th, then Joseph gets the rest of the revelation. And if you want to read it, it's in section 132, verse 51 through 54. And this is what it now read. What this is the instructions to Emma. Now that the laws have turned them down for this substitute deal with Joseph, not a marriage. Okay. He writes that the revelation is that she stay herself and partake not of that which I commanded you to offer unto her. For I did it, saith the Lord, to prove you all, as I did Abraham. That's what Joseph's now
So he
saying.
falls back on the Abrahamic sacrifice
Yes.
thing. Okay.
And a lot of that just simply means I really didn't want you to accept my proposal. I accept the proposals of pretty girls. I mean, no, that's a little over the top, but that could be interpreted that way.
Okay.
Let my handmaid Emma Smith receive all those that have been given unto my servant Joseph. I command mine handmaid Emma Smith to abide and cleave unto my servant Joseph and to none else. See, there it is. But if she will not abide this commandment, she shall be destroyed, saith the Lord. For I am the Lord thy God and will destroy her.
Yeah, like how is Emma going along with this? Like, as I
I'll tell
understand
you.
it, oh, go ahead.
So Emma's talked to William quite a bit, and William records both Joseph and Emma's comments on those verses we just read. To Joseph, he thought the revelation would cause Emma to submit peacefully, as it threatened her removal if she did not. That's what Law's saying that Joseph's reaction was. So he thinks Emma will comply. Emma confided to Law that the revelation, which she did not believe in, by the way, quote, was a threat against her life if she did not comply. That's a quote.
You thought that maybe Emma thought Joseph would take her out.
That's what Emma thinks.
Okay, all right, all right.
Joseph uses the word removal and destroy, destroying the revelation and removal to William Smith.
And if Joseph, if, you know, one could, it's clear that some people thought that Joseph committed the murder of Boggs, and so it's not hard to draw lines and say, well, if Joseph could command the murder of Boggs, he could do it to me, Emma, or someone else, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
The day Joseph Smith died, this is what Smith wrote. Joseph Smith was unscrupulous. No man's life was safe if he was disposed to hate him.
Who wrote this? Who wrote this again?
William Law, on the very day Joseph
Go.
Died, June 27th, 1844,
okay.
in his diary.
Got it.
He was unscrupulous. No man's life was safe if he was disposed to hate him. He set the laws of God and men at defiance. So he sets it right there the day he dies in Carthage. So he believes this. Okay, so Emma then says to Law, Law said that Emma, quote, spoke repeatedly about that pretended revelation, 132, and says, I must submit or be destroyed. Well, I guess I have to submit.
Right.
So that's how that goes down. All right. Now, several months after the substitute for Joseph incident, Joseph approaches William Law to be a plural wife of his. This is in November, December. And it's just baffling because here the laws have already turned him down on the substitute sex deal. And now he's approaching Jane Law when William isn't home and wants to marry her. This comes right from Alexander Niebuhr, who's a good friend of Joseph Smith. And it also comes from Jackson and so forth. And this is in November and December of 1843, probably December. So it's like 4 or 5 months later. And Joseph is asking Law to marry Jane, to marry him. She's very attractive. She's 30 years old. Joseph is 38. William Law's 36, I'm guessing. Emma's probably 39. I think she's a year older than Joseph. So that's what's going down. So on January 1st, the Law records in his diary.
This is 1844, the year of Joseph's death.
Yeah. See, the marriage proposal to Jane is in November, December 43. Now it's January 1st. And in his diary, he just really emotionally says, we've had one heck of a year, and we have rejected Smith's proposals about polygamy, the latest one about being a polygamous wife. And then he tells Jackson this. He says, Jackson, I've tried for 2 months to get Mrs. William Law for a spiritual polygamous wife, but I can't do anything to convince her of the correctness of my doctrine, and I have not succeeded. And then he hires Jackson to take Smith out, according to Jackson. And he says this. On Sunday morning, Joseph and I had a long talk concerning Law, in which he avowed, not for the first time, however, his determination to put Law out of the way, for he had become dangerous to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and that it was the will of God that he should be removed. So he's hiring him. And we have other writers who are writing on this. It's not just Jackson, okay? He, however, wished to proceed in such a manner that he would be able to get Law's wife. In other words, he wants to do it incognito. This is according to Jackson. There's also affidavits on that Jackson was hired to kill Law. Okay. So they turned Joseph down on Jane being Joseph's plural wife, and by the 8th of January, Law is dropped as a counselor in the first presidency of the church. And then on April 18th, the laws are excommunicated from the church.
Okay. So the laws, okay, so wow. So the claim here is that, I'm just going to summarize, that Emma wanted William Law as a spiritual or even as a real plural partner.
No, not a husband, a sexual partner, according to the laws.
That approach was made, and the laws turned that down. Later, Joseph tried to approach Jane Law to be a plural wife of his, and that was also turned down.
Turned down, yeah. And then a week later, he's dropped from the first presidency. And a couple of months later, he's ex- the both of them are excommunicated.
And this is and this this, I mean, wow, this sounds like high drama of a sort. I've actually, you know, I've read enough to perceive a lot of high drama in Nauvoo, especially in those last 3 or 4 years. But this is sort of drama of the highest possible sort.
Yeah,
because we're talking about swinging, wife swapping. We're talking about potential murder. The part of this that does corroborate with what I've read is the fact that Joseph would proposition people's wives, even when they were married to other men at the time.
Well, Jane Law's married.
Right. And we know that at least, what, 8 of Joseph's 30-plus wives were married 11. To other men. 11 were married to other men at the time Joseph took them on.
And we found 2 more since that book was written by Todd.
Right. And we also know that sometimes Joseph would send people on missions.
Oh, yeah.
And then proposition their wives while they were here. So, okay.
So this incident caused a breach between Joseph and Law. This is what triggered it.
But and I just, what was going through Joseph's mind? Like, this is crazy.
I don't know.
What was he thinking?
I don't know. I honestly don't. It's but it involves the entire first presidency of the church. It involves Sidney Rigdon's daughter, Nancy. It involves John Bennett doing his thing, whether it's authorized or not. He's doing that. And it involves the laws, his first, second counselor.
Crazy.
It is crazy.
Okay. All right. Now, I want to talk about the Nauvoo Expositor. Do you know about the Nauvoo Expositor?
I mean, sure.
Okay. You talk about the kingdom, political kingdom of God as your third point. Should we talk about that and then come back to the Expositor? Or should we talk about the Expositor now?
Let's talk about the Expositor right now. Let's see. Now, let me just say a couple of things about the proposals of Joseph.
Okay.
So, and this kind of ties in to the Expositor, okay. Which, by the way, means to expose.
Right.
So, the laws, they think this is ridiculous. There's only 100 people in Nauvoo who probably know about the stuff that we know about. And by the way, the 1845 census of Illinois shows there was, 11,800 something people living in Nauvoo proper city.
Okay.
And then another 5,000 outside of the city limits. So this is a big community. This is what, 18,000 people.
Right.
Just to compare, Chicago in the 1845 census had 10,000 something. So 1,000 something less than what's in Nauvoo. So this is a pretty big city.
Right.
And Carthage has 300 people. Warsaw has less than that. I mean, these are the surrounding areas. So William and Jane Law and Dr. Foster and his wife and there's two there and a few others, they think, what in the heck are we going to do about this? And they said, well, let's get up a printing press. And Law put $2,000 in, and the rest of them put, $700-800, and they rented a building on Main Street there, right by the Kraus Furniture Store now stands in Nauvoo. And by the way, there's no plaque on there, and this incident about the destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor is what triggered Joseph Smith's events to leading to his death and the exodus of the Mormons from Illinois.
Right.
And there's no plaque. There's nothing. It's a very important
part of our history that we have.
Somebody needs to put a plaque up there. And the Krauses, I understand, I was going to talk to him when I was back there in October or September, but I didn't get around to it, but I think they would probably be amenable to that. I think somebody needs to approach them anyway. So, the first thing the laws do is they get this building and they get a printing press and they're into this $3,000 and then they write up a prospectus and they send it out to the community, and it tells everybody what they're going to do. Now, very, very few people, we're talking, I don't know, maybe 100, 200 people know about this out of 18,000, okay? So this becomes very dangerous for Joseph Smith to have the facts revealed. And this paper had one and only one issue. It came out on a Friday, but it was designed to come out every Friday. But of course, the press was destroyed, and this led to consequences for the laws. By it came out on the 8th of 7th or 8th of June, and by the 12th, the laws felt so threatened, they just left the community and never returned. They just thought their lives were threatened. They lost all that property we mentioned earlier. They just walked away from it.
But let's talk about what the not what that Nauvoo Expositor claimed.
Well, it claimed two of the three reasons why the laws left the church. One is the polygamy thing, and another is the political kingdom of God, which was set up on March 1144, called the Council of 50. And that's a big subject, and we won't go into that too much, but it says right in the minutes that Joseph Smith had himself ordained king of the earth in
Right,
there.
right.
And of course, Brigham Young was in 1847 and John Taylor in 1885. So this was a long going thing. They actually thought they were going to take over, give laws for the world, and eventually help Christ usher in his millennial reign. So this leaks out. And William Law has an entry on Joseph is ordained king on April 11th, 44, and by the 15th, the laws already know about it, even though they're about to be excommunicated. 4 days later, they're going to be excommunicated. But he records in his diary, he says, this is the straw that breaks the camel's back. This is the idea of Smith being a theocrat, of dictating everything that happens here in our community and having worldwide vision of it all, and being, king over the earth and president pro temp of the world. That's an actual phrase by Heber C. Kimball. They couldn't. They wrote that up in the Nauvoo Expositor, the one and only edition, and they said something like, "It's a sacred duty to advocate unmitigated disobedience to political revelations and to censure and decry gross moral imperfections wherever found, either in the plebeian, perdition, or self-constituted monarch." So they know he's. They declared him to be a god in that council and a king over the earth. And the laws just says, "I've had enough. This is it." And so they excommunicated him 4 days later.
Okay, so I'm gonna just go back a bit. So just to summarize what you said, it seems like Joseph kind of, went crazy towards the end, because he creates this Council of 50, he gets himself anointed as king of the world, and he sort of starts talking about ushering in this theocracy where he's not just going to rule Nauvoo or the United States, but he's ultimately going to rule the world, right?
Right.
And this is accepted widely by faithful and non-faithful historians. The church has the Council of the 50 Minutes in its vault somewhere, as I understand it, right?
And they have not let scholars see them to
Yeah.
this date.
Yeah.
And
So,
I
yeah.
think because it may, we don't know what's in those minutes, frankly, but it
Right.
could be treasonous kind of stuff.
Yeah. And so what we hear from, what we see from the laws is that they see that Joseph's willing, may potentially willing to kill or assassinate people. They see that he's propositioning young girls, immigrants that come over from England or wherever. He seems to be preying upon young girls. He seems to be preying upon other men's wives. Now he's done that to the laws themselves
Well, in
on multiple
section
occasions.
132, section 132, verse 61 says he's only supposed to approach virgins. And so obviously married women are not virgins, so he's breaking his own commandment.
Okay. And then finally, like you said, the straw that breaks the camel's back is when he declares himself king of the world, right?
Yeah.
And so the Nauvoo Expositor, These are basically the claims that the Nauvoo Expositor basically
Yes.
makes. It's not like this newspaper offers a bunch of lies. In fact,
No.
what it's doing is it's saying, I, William Law, along with seven or eight other people, you know, we were there. We know Joseph. And the crazy thing is they actually, just like David Whitmer, they start out, don't they start out by saying, we still believe in the Book of Mormon, we still believe in the Restoration?
It says that right in the Nauvoo Expositor.
Yeah, just like, so it's not like they're total disbelievers or heretics.
No.
They still believe in part of what Joseph, you know, did. But they go on to say that this guy must have been a fallen prophet. Again, just like David
That's
Whitmer.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
200 or 300 people meet at Law's house. And that's the gist of it all. He's a fallen prophet. And what are we, you know, what are we going to do about it?
So what they do is they write this up in the Nauvoo Expositor, and the main two claims, other than that he's fallen, is that he's doing this polygamy stuff, this exaltation stuff, these controversial doctrines like the King Follett discourse, you know, men becoming
yeah.
gods. So
yeah.
theologically, he's gone crazy. He's
well,
got too much power.
Fallen prophet.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the fallen prophet. And see, the laws, they says we hung in there because we thought we could reform him, get him to stop doing this stuff. But he went full bore ahead. The laws, once the prospectus of the Nauvoo Expositor is out, remember the Expositor appears on June 7th, 44, but on May 10th, the prospectus is given to the community. So they know it's coming.
Right.
And in that, soon as that prospectus hits the streets, there is Sidney Rigdon over there on the Law's doorstep in behalf of Joseph. And he says, look, we don't want this stuff out. We will reinstate you in the first presidency. We'll admit that we cut you off from the church and you weren't even in attendance. We will admit all this stuff. And the Law says, well, we have a few things we want before we're going to come back. And that one, you know, and they start ticking these things off. About polygamy, you got to say it's from hell and all this other stuff. And Rigdon says, well, I'm not authorized to offer you that. And then 3 weeks later, out comes the Expositor, really giving their serious grievances.
Right. And so, and every, you know, most of my listeners know this, but if there's someone who's new to this history, I'm just going to finish drawing the lines. The Nauvoo Expositor is released. It's declared a menace by the council that oversees Nauvoo, of which Joseph is what? The mayor or
he's the mayor.
Yeah. And it's declared a nuisance, a public nuisance, and you know, thugs basically come and destroy the printing press, right?
Yes.
They physically destroy the printing press. Which of course is what? A violation of law in terms of the destruction of private property and a violation of the freedom of press. Is that right?
Yeah, and if you read the document, there's really very little in here from a perspective of today that was false. I can't hardly see anything. They have 15 resolutions, and as far as I can tell, those things are true about what was going on in Nauvoo.
Yeah, and I'm gonna go ahead and provide a link to the full text, you know, a full reproduction of the document. But the biggest, the most scandalous thing in there is that he's seducing young women, right?
Yeah, when they first come over from England, primarily, or
yeah, that these young poor immigrant girls are.
Yeah,
coming
the
over.
First thing you got to have an audience with Joseph, and then bang, you know, they're.
Yeah, and to be honest, when you think about the crazy stuff that like Warren Jeffs is doing, it you know you kind of think that Warren Jeffs basically is just really studied, you know, or the fundamentalists they've just really studied and taken seriously, you know, 1842 to 1844 Mormonism and Joseph.
They're Joseph Smith Mormons.
Yeah, and so they're doing Mormonism like Joseph did towards the end of his life, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And so the printing press gets destroyed, word gets back, and, you know, the governor of Illinois get involved? And
yes.
He basically says, you know, Joseph, we got to put you in jail. I think he may have even promised Joseph to protect him, but because he needed to get Joseph in jail. And he said, if you'll get in jail, I'll protect you. But the idea was, I, as governor of this state, I can't have people destroying printing presses in America. without there being at least some type of trial
and declaring yourself a king.
I think
it's Ford who said that Nauvoo was a government within the state of Illinois,
right?
Because of that charter. It was a very generous charter, and the laws thought that this was the beginning of our problems in Nauvoo, because it gave too much power to Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
And he just kind of went from there.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a rogue state, a rogue city, a rogue religion, and a bit of a rogue prophet, and things unravel. And so that's why Joseph Smith went to Carthage, for the destruction of the printing press, and of course it was there that he was assassinated by the mob. But that's why I always like to say that it was polygamy that killed Joseph. I mean, it really was, right? I mean, it was.
No, just... there's about five reasons. One of them was masonry. He'd given away the temple ceremony and did it all in one setting, and it normally took years to get there. There were a group of those. This kingdom on earth was part of it. Polygamy was part of it, and the young man and cattle stealing, carriage stealing. That was another group in the mob. And finally, we have one young man. When Joseph jumped out of the window, he wanted to cut his head off, and they interviewed him and says, why? He says, because he violated my sister.
Right.
So you've got multiple reasons why they, and this isn't just a theory. This Illinois historian is doing a major book on the martyrdom of Joseph and Hiram Smith. Not just Joseph Jackson, but the martyrdom of Joseph and Hiram. And also, we'll probably do something eventually on Nauvoo polygamy. He's found more stuff than I think anybody, or beyond what we have now. And we found a lot.
So what are some good books? Let's say that people are like, Grant Palmer's pulling this out of his rear. This is anti-Mormon evil things. What are some books that people can read to read the primary sources on all this story?
Well, if they'll go to my home page, I've got everything documented. They can go there. The William Clayton's journal is some of this, and while extracts have been published, the church has not released those journals of Smith, just as they have not released the minutes of the Council of 50. But the sources are in here.
Okay. Well, you haven't released this William Law. Is the William Law thing released?
The time you get your podcast out, it will be on mormonthink.com under What's New.
Okay.
As the allegations is already there, sexual allegations.
And all the sources will be there. But if someone wants to just get a sense for how Nauvoo ended, what are some good books that at least corroborate the Council of 50 stuff, the Nauvoo Expositor stuff, the polygamy stuff? What are just some good books that people can read to just corroborate a lot of that general history? What would you recommend?
Well, Klaus Hansen, A Quest for Empire, was written, I think, in 1967. It's a bit dated, but you can get an awful lot of information on that. But if you want to get in to just the Nauvoo Council of 50, not Utah, Andrew Ehad has done a lot of work. Michael Quinn has done a lot of work. There's a couple of articles in BYU Studies on it.
It doesn't No Man Know My History kind of cover generally a lot of this?
No, I've probably forgotten. I honestly can't remember that. But people ought to read the Nauvoo Expositor. That's a place to start.
Yeah, it's kind of a primary source. Okay, and I'm sure Rough Stone Rolling covers this too, right? At least in some detail.
Again, I can't remember. I read that so long ago. I'm 70, going on 72 here in the memory, you know? Let me just say one more thing about the laws.
Sure.
When the laws sat down, by August, they sat down and says, my gosh, Joseph Smith has no respect for the Ten Commandments, and he has no respect for the Sermon on the Mount. And they went through and indicted Joseph Smith with blasphemy or using God's name in vain. That's one of the ten. Committing murder, committing adultery, stealing and robbing from the Gentiles, including themselves, bearing false witness, and coveting the wives of other men.
Mm.
In other words, they broke six of the Ten Commandments. That's what they're indicting him for.
And where's that written?
In my paper.
Okay, all right.
But it's also in, let's see, it's in William Law's correspondence in August of 1844, 1 month after Smith dies.
Okay.
And then he says, that Joseph Smith, quote, was one of the false prophets spoken of by Christ who would come in sheep's clothing, but inwardly be a ravening wolf. His works proved it. He's quoting Matthew 7, 15 and 16. He claimed to be a god, whereas he was only a servant of the devil, and as such met his fate. That's 1 month after Smith, 2 months after he met his, after he was killed. And then 43 years later, when he finally starts talking about it, he hasn't softened his view. He says, the great mistake of my life was having anything to do with Mormonism. I feel it to be a deep disgrace and never speak of it when I can avoid it. For over 40 years, I have almost been entirely silent on the subject. It's very painful for him. Now, whether you believe him or not, you know, apologists might just say, oh, he's a liar, and that's the end of it. But I think that's why a first-rate biography of Law is important, to establish what kind of man he really was, because I grew up thinking the worst things about some of these men, and I'm finding it isn't true.
Yeah, and it's not just that. I mean, you know, fine, William Law's dead. Like, you know, that could be enough. But this whole podcast series that we've talked about so far is basically just focusing on a couple aspects of Joseph's life, right?
Yeah.
That's
yes.
Very different from what we've been taught growing up in the church. You know, we're taught the simplified whitewash version, mm-hmm. and now we've got all this stuff. Now, this stuff could be true, could be false, could be partially true, it could be inaccurate, but this is just one set of historical stories and evidence that we have that certainly gives people credible, you know, credible pause or reasons to start questioning, you know, the church's truth claims.
Well, that's why they don't want to talk about them.
Right. And what's not fair is that when someone reads this stuff and finds out about it, they start trying to talk in Elders Quorum or Relief Society, and it's not acceptable. They try and reach out to family members and friends, and
they shut them down.
They shut them down, and they say this is dangerous anti-Mormon stuff. Get away from it. And to whatever extent someone tries to, they go to their bishop and say, "Can you help me understand this?" The bishop's never heard it before, and the bishop treats them like they're sinners and needs to repent. And there's no place for them to go, and they either they suffer in silence, and get depression and anxiety and become mentally ill, or they try and talk publicly and become ostracized and potentially lose their marriage and their spouse and whatever.
Yeah, and we have enough. We have a few rogue bishops out there. Will say to say to the wife, "Well, if he doesn't believe, you might as well divorce him." I mean, that's against church counsel, but it's happening.
Oh, absolutely.
I know
it's still happening in some places. And so, you know, I guess there's a meta point that we're trying to make here. There is the history about Joseph and William Law, and people can go read the primary sources and decide what they want to. But there's a bigger meta issue that we're covering, and that's that not only did William Law and many, many other people feel like they had a credible reason to leave the church, you know, but also today people who learn this history feel the same way. And so, you know, this is a real problem that we need to face as a church and as a culture, is how do we become aware of the facts, and then how do we create space and empathy and support for people who lose their faith? Because I'm sure you could attest, it's no fun to lose your faith, right?
So it's about the saddest thing that ever happened in my life, other than my wife's first wife's death. I mean, it's just an unbelievable blow.
And so you didn't run out and say, "What can I do to lose my testimony today?" Right?
No. Heavens, no. It's just, you know, my story's not so dramatic. It's just the case of the shelf getting, you know, building two or three shelves, and then they all came crashing down.
Yeah, because you were, I mean, I assume you were a seminary and institute teacher in good faith. You didn't.
Absolutely.
You didn't dedicate your life to that just so that you could screw the church in the end, right?
No, I taught it for 34 years, and I never talked about any of the stuff in my book or what we talk about today. Not that I knew it then, but no, I was faithful. It's just that simple. If they want to say I was a wolf in sheep's clothing, it looks to me like the laws are saying it was Smith that was the, you know, and why, why do they treat us so poorly? You know, your own family will treat you poorly because they don't know and they don't want to know. Ignorance really is the softest pillow, and they prefer ignorance.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that, so I appreciate you taking us through this. And it's tough stuff to hear. I mean, really, I can't imagine anything more scandalous than what we've covered today, right? I mean, this is just beyond whatever I've ever heard.
Well, that's why I wrote it up. I mean, he's a member of the First Presidency. Do you know anybody who's left the church for these three reasons? Well, no. Did you get death threats? Well, no. Did you get your wife hit on? No. Did you find out what happens when someone declares himself king of the earth and how it starts dictating in temporal policy and all that? I mean, come on. People, they're leaving for none of the reasons that are in my book.
Right, right. And so you know, this guy deserves our love and respect and appreciation and our admiration, not our scorn, right?
Well, like I say, a first-rate biography needs to be written.
Yeah,
I'm not going to defend it, but what I've seen so far, this was a good man. He was called a good man. That's a quote, unquote.
Yeah.
And I see no reason that he wasn't. Now, some of the apologists will say, well, he once testified in a court in Carthage, and he was caught lying under oath. And I think someone needs to answer that piece of work that's apparently on farms.
Sure.
I don't know that discredits him for everything and all the things we've been talking about today.
Yeah, if only farms were as objective about Joseph Smith's life as they were about his critics.
Yes.
It seems like they're willing to dig up anything on anyone who might be a critic, but they're not willing to apply the same level of scrutiny to Joseph's own life.
Or anyone who writes a book favorable.
Right, right.
They don't scrutinize them like right. They do critics. Yeah.
That's right, that's right. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints. No toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far. To drive to the sand joy, your hearts will swell. Oh, all is well, all is well. should we die before our journey's through? Happy day.